Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 174, Murder Most Psychological, September 19th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
This is what drives me crazy, is psychologists in movies and books who are crazier than their patients, or they have no boundaries. When I started out to write these books, I said that there is something that I can do better than that. I don't mean make perfect people be the psychologists, but have them have reasonable problems that they're handling responsibly and still doing a good job.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Roberta Islib, clinical psychologist and successful mystery writer. I just finished her latest mystery, Asking for Murder. You can find out more about Dr. Islib in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Roberta Islib, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much for having me join you.
Did I say your name right? I wasn't sure how to pronounce it.
You came very close. It's Islib.
Islib. Okay. I should have asked you before we got started, but I'm delighted to have you on the show. I've read two of your mysteries now, and I've enjoyed them both. But before we get into that, how does such a nice psychologist lady like you get involved in Murder Most Foul?
Everybody wants to know how a nice middle-aged lady got involved with that. It really started with a golf fixation. When I met this guy that I'm married to now, I wasn't a golfer and I wasn't a writer. I was a tennis player and I had my practice in clinical psychology, but he was a golfer, and you remember what it's like in those first rosy days of a relationship when the person says, let's try such and such.
Oh, yes.
And you say, doesn't that sound wonderful? And so when he said, let's go play a few holes of golf, I went, and then I got hooked on both of them, the man and the golf. And I was such a horrible student. It took me so much time and money to learn to play that I had to do something with it. And really, that's the crazy answer, but it's true that the idea that came out of that eventually was writing a murder mystery series featuring a lady golfer.
What a strange entry into writing.
I know. It's really very odd.
Yeah, and I got the impression from the two novels that I read, which are not part of your golfing series, but are rather part of your advice column mystery series, that the heroine didn't much care for golf.
No, this new heroine, who is a clinical psychologist, very similar to the kind of practice that I had, her name's Rebecca Butterman, and she does not like golf at all. She had a cameo appearance in the second and third books in the golf series, and both she and my first character, who was a lady golfer, were interested in the same guy. And so there's always been some negative feelings, both between them and from this character, Rebecca, about golf.
Okay, yeah, I'm just looking at the at one of the front pages of your book, and it looks like you've got five of the golf lover mysteries, and this most recent one is the third of the advice column mysteries.
That's right.
Well, yeah. Tell us a bit about your background. I'm thinking, you know, like where you grew up, went to school, all that good stuff.
Okay. This sort of explains my odd entree into writing, because I'm the kind of person who wanders around until I find myself. So I grew up in New Jersey with a few years in Michigan. Then I went to Princeton. Then I worked in a bookstore for a year. Then I went and got a master's degree in vocational rehabilitation counseling in Tennessee. Worked at that for a few years. Then went to school at the University of Florida for my PhD in clinical psych. And then came to Yale to do a postdoc. Worked here for 13 years. And then this writing thing came up. Yeah. So I'm not a straight shot kind of person.
Well, neither am I. You're in good company. Now, is there a particular approach to psychotherapy that you're aligned with?
My postgraduate training, which was at the Yale Hospital and then at the Yale Student Services, was psychodynamic. A lot of the teachers, in fact, were psychoanalysts. So that's the kind of the perspective that I come from as far as therapy goes. For people who aren't don't know a whole lot about therapy, that means really understanding your past and your family history and how that gets dragged forward into the present and applied to situations where it may not really fit.
Yes, actually, I have a similar training background myself. And since the psychodynamic approach does depend upon the past, let me ask you a little bit of a challenging question. Can you recall anything in your past, growing up as a child, an incident, a memory, that in some way might have foreshadowed this writing career or this interest in murder?
Tell that's a hard question. I'll give you an easy answer, which is I was a bookworm, and I read every Nancy Drew that came out, and so that's a natural connection. There is in the first book in the Advice Column series, there is a theme about suicide. I'm not going to say too much about it because someone might want to read the book and I don't want to spoil it.
Sure.
But there was in the neighborhood, which was a very nice, normal, suburban neighborhood where I lived, there was a woman down the street who committed suicide, leaving her two toddlers alone with her in the house. And say, I might have been 9 or 10 years old. That had a big effect. Mm-hmm. Questions about how could a mother do that? What was she thinking and feeling? And what kind of effect might it have had on those children? So that is a theme that comes all through this first book, Deadly Advice.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And thanks for being willing to rise to the bait of that question.
Sure.
Now, I have the impression that you're no longer in private practice. Is that right?
That's right. As I've gotten busier with writing and with the volunteer jobs that I've been doing along with that, the therapy just faded out as the writing got bigger.
Yeah. Does that mean that your writing career has taken off sufficiently that you no longer need the income from private practice? I mean, are you like cleaning up with your books?
No, that doesn't mean that. If I didn't have a perfectly nice husband who had an income, I'd be getting another job.
Okay.
It's a tough business to depend on for your full-time income.
Well, that's my impression, and so that's partly why I wanted to ask that, because I think you have to be extraordinarily successful in a writing career for that to begin to happen.
Right, and I consider myself to be relatively successful with 8 books published by a major publisher, but still the money... the money is not there unless you really make it to another level.
Yes, yes. Well, we will keep our fingers crossed and wait for you to jump up to that next level. And now, before we leave the topic of your own kind of history as a psychotherapist. What did you find to be the joys and the challenges of being a psychotherapist? The parts that you really loved and the parts not so much?
The part that I really loved was seeing people begin to understand themselves and move out of the quagmire that they often came into my office settled into. And that would take some time. You know, some people I saw for months and others for years. But so that was the thing that I loved, was seeing people really change their lives and become happier people. The part that I didn't love was the always being tied to it. So if you're in private practice by yourself, you are always on call. And so if somebody had an emergency in the night, they called you. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to go on vacation, well, you had to set up backup with another therapist, and then you had to go through people being angry because you were leaving, and then people being angry when you got back because you left, and all of that, that was hard.
Yes, yes. That certainly makes a lot of sense to me. Are you by any chance a fan of Robert B. Parker of the Spencer novels?
I've read a couple of his novels. He certainly knows how to write something that moves along lickety-split. I admire him.
Yes, me too. He's one of my favorites. And I thought I saw a bit of his influence in your work, so that's why I asked.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, that would be a compliment. Who are your favorite mystery writers?
Some of the ones that I like, that I really enjoy, and I read a lot because I have a lot of friends now who are in the mystery business, but I think Michael Connelly is a master.
Oh, yes. I've read some of him.
His series is set in Los Angeles, and he has this very kind of dark police detective who has a wonderfully difficult backstory himself. And that he carries that through all his books, the fact that this man had such a tragic history. It helps to explain why he's so intense about the work of being a detective. I think he's a wonderful writer. There's another dark guy whose name is Arnaldur Indridason. He's Icelandic, so it's hard for me to pronounce that. Mm-hmm. But he also has one of these very depressive detectives. And because it's set in Iceland, it's always dark and cold, and he's just a wonderful writer. Julia Spencer Fleming is a woman writer who writes a series that's set in the I think it's in the Adirondacks, and she has an Episcopalian priest who's a woman who works with the small town police detective, and the tension between those two characters is really masterful. So those are a couple of the ones that I really enjoy.
Oh, that's great. I think my wife may have read that Icelandic author that you referred to. She's a much more prolific reader than I am, and she sometimes turns me on to books. As a matter of fact, it was she was the one who brought Robert Parker to me once when I was sick, and she brought me a stack of his books saying, I think you'll like these, and I got hooked. I'm not sure if you know that I interviewed two other psychologists who write mysteries, Stephen White and Dennis Palumbo.
Yes, I listened to both of those interviews.
Oh, great.
In fact, then I stole Dennis Palumbo from you, and we interviewed him on our group blog, which is Jungle Red Writers, because he works with writers who are stuck, which is just fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah. I hope you won't take offense, but I thought I saw a lot of growth between your 2006 Deadly Advice and your new 2008 Asking for Murder. Does that fit your own sense of things?
Oh, I could. If you said I went the other direction, I would take offense. But I love hearing that I've improved. It's what I aspire to, is just trying to learn more and be a better writer and also a better plotter and a better understander of character. I had no training in writing fiction, so I feel like I'm learning on the job.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, whether you have attended writers' workshops, retreats, those kinds of things.
I have. I have done all of the above. I've joined the mystery writing organizations that are important in the field, which are Mystery Writers of America and then Sisters in Crime, which, in fact, I'm the national president of this year. But so through those organizations, I've gone to quite a few conferences, and then I've taken just classes in anything. I don't know if you've heard of William Zinsser. He wrote on writing well.
Yes.
So I went to a class of his in New York, which had nothing to do with fiction or mysteries, but just writing. And then I took a class in children's books, just trying to get the writing part down and the fiction part down, because I knew nothing about this. Probably the thing that maybe helped me the most was hiring an independent editor who, it was like a private tutorial.
Uh-huh.
And she was really wonderful. She really just focused on every aspect of my writing, using words to grammar to illogical plot points, to trying to shove characters into a plot because I wanted them to go somewhere when it really didn't make sense. I mean, she was very, very helpful.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yes, getting back to your most recent one, Asking for Murder, it felt more sophisticated to me, somehow more sophisticated, more complex, more compelling to me as a man. The other one that I read felt a little bit more like, they say chick flick. Well, it's not a flick, but it's a, what's the corresponding
chick
thing in a book?
Chick lit, yeah.
A chick lit, yeah. That, it had a bit more of that feeling for me as a man. This one, I think, moved a little better, a little faster. You mentioned that about Robert Parker's book. So I think you're on the right trajectory.
Oh, good. but one of the differences or one of the changes that I've seen as I've written 8 books is people often ask, do you outline where the book is going ahead of time? And I have gotten better at doing that because I think that for me it works better to know where the story's going. And of course, there's always room for a lot of changes as you start to fill the story out. But it's an interesting thing about writers is I have a couple of friends who don't outline anything and wouldn't even consider it because they like to find out what's happening as the reader is.
Yes.
Whereas for my work, it seems to go better if I spend more time really forcing myself to know what the story is first.
Uh-huh. I wondered about that. Do you have a particular routine for your writing? Like, are you a morning writer, evening writer? Do you do it every day?
I'm a morning writer. Definitely no good in the evening. And I pretty much write every day. It's a full-time job. I take the deadline that the book is due and then work backwards to figure out how many pages a week have to get done in order to get it sent in on time. And I build in time for my writer's group to read and critique. And I have a couple of other friends who are readers, too. And so that's an extra couple of months in there. And then it's just, say it's 15 or 20 pages a week that has to get written. I sit down in the morning, and if I get, by some act of God, got 15 done in a day, then I wouldn't have to do anything the rest of the week. But if I do nothing a whole day, then I have to get busy for the next couple of days. So that's a way I keep myself going.
That's a fascinating way to structure it. Do you ever find yourself just drawing a blank on a given day and sitting there and getting nothing done?
I do, but there are some pretty good tricks for how to get past that. One is just rereading what you've done before so you can remind yourself of where the story is. Another is to, and I think it was Elmore Leonard who suggested that you always leave off during one day's work in the middle of something so that you're excited to go back. If you end a day at the end of a chapter, somehow it's psychologically harder to get going the next day.
Interesting.
And I have a lot of buddies who I can call and whine to and say, you know, I'm not doing anything. And even there was one friend who she and I would call each other and then we'd say, okay, we're working for the next 45 minutes and then we'll call again. So just really setting small deadlines is very helpful too.
Those are some great tips. And you mentioned Elmore Leonard. He's another one of my favorites. He just he depicts these delicious psychopaths.
Yes.
It's the only way I can describe it. I always feel like, I think I've known somebody like that somewhere along the way.
Yes, he's a marvelous writer.
Yes. Now, you know, I wanted to be a writer, but I think I discovered that I don't have the imagination or the concentration that's required. Are you able to visualize the scenes, or is it more just a juggling of words, if you know what I mean?
I would say it's more a juggling of words, and then if I'm really getting into the story, it becomes more clear. That I mentioned to you that I had hired this editor for a couple of my books, and what she kept saying is, you really have to try to get into the viewpoint of your character. And if she's going to say, I have this character who's going to be discovering a dead body, she wouldn't just say, oh my, look what I found. She would have strong reactions. And based on her history and who you've made her, how would she react? And so the more I can do that is to really get inside the character and then let them lead the way, then the more I can see the story. I do have a friend who describes being able to see it as though it was a movie, which that's not how my mind works. That would be neat.
Yeah, it would be. I'm afraid my mind works more like your mind works, that it's somehow it's putting together words rather than visualizing things ahead of time. What do you think of the way psychologists are portrayed in the media? You've got a psychologist heroine, Dr. Rebecca Butterman, and I'm thinking of things like Good Will Hunting, Robin Williams, and there's the psychiatrist in Sopranos. There's HBO's In Treatment, which I discussed with psychologist and psychoanalyst Fern Cohen. What do you think about shrinks in the media?
This is one of my pet peeves. Did you see the movie Tin Cup?
No, I'm not sure. I think I might have avoided that one.
Okay. It was an entertaining movie, especially if you were interested in golf. And it was Kevin Costner, who I always like. But he was trying to make a comeback on the, I forget what the tournament was, some big, the U.S. Open or some big tournament. And so he went to a psychologist to get help. And she turned into such an idiot. By the end of the movie, of course, she was his girlfriend sleeping with him. And this is what drives me crazy is psychologists in movies and books who are crazier than their patients or they have no boundaries. When I started out to write these books, I said that there is something that I can do better than that. I don't mean make perfect people be the psychologists, but have them have reasonable problems that they're handling responsibly and still doing a good job. It makes me nuts, this subject.
Yeah, it's kind of a cultural stereotype in a way, isn't it? that psychologists and psychotherapists are nuttier than the people that they're treating.
It is. And doesn't it make you wonder why it's that way? What is it that there is an unconscious fear of professional mental health people, so we put them down? I don't know. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, that is an interesting theory. Now, speaking of heroes of books who are psychologists themselves, my wife gave me a book titled A Death in Vienna, and I have yet to read it, but she raved about it. It's written by a London clinical psychologist by the name of Frank Tallis. Do you know that one?
No, I don't, but I'm writing it down.
Yeah, A Death in Vienna. She liked it a lot. It's on my It's on my to-do list.
Okay.
Do you find that your training as a psychologist helps you as a writer?
I think it helps me. It helps me construct reasonable characters or characters that feel real. People often say your books have a very real feeling to them. And in this new series, the Advice Column series, the main character is a clinical psychology who has a private practice in therapy. And it's really very similar to the one that I had. So I know in a way that I just never was going to with a professional golfer because I just was no good. I can understand what a clinical psychologist does. I know exactly what it's like to sit both on both sides of the couch as a therapist and a patient. And I feel like I can explain that and have that be a natural part of the story in a way that was harder with the golf.
Yes. Is there some way that a writer is like a therapist or vice versa?
Let's see. Well, certainly people, readers project their own issues onto a book and onto an author. So I guess that would be a similarity. That one I'll have to think over. That's a good question.
I think it was triggered by my own sense of myself that initially I had this ambition to be a writer, and then somehow I gravitated towards becoming a psychotherapist. And I felt there was a similarity because I felt that both wrestle with the brass tacks of what it is to be human.
That sounds good.
Okay. Well, it was true for me, and I just wanted to check it out with you.
I'll buy that.
Okay. You know, I love the advice columns, the advice column bits that you throw into your advice column series. Clearly, you'd be great at that. Did you, in fact, ever write an advice column?
No, I'm an advice column junkie, though.
Ah.
There's a column in the Ladies' Home Journal called Can This Marriage Be Saved? And I would buy that magazine every month just to read the column. And they would take a case from a real therapist. I'm not sure how they did this with the confidentiality issues, but then the therapist would present the man's side and the woman's side, and then sum up the work they did and how they worked things out. I just love reading that thing. So when I was thinking about what would be an interesting hook for this series besides the psychology, the advice column angle seemed like fun. Now, I've sent the books to some advice columnists just because you're trying to spread the word about them being out there.
Yeah.
Gotten a couple of comments about that her advice is not very earth-shattering, that is kind of dull.
Huh.
So I don't know. It's made me think maybe that isn't the direction I'll be going in. But I think there's a tendency to want to kind of show off in a column like that for the advice columnist.
Yes.
To want to, you know, show off how clever they are.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I thought you pulled it off, but of course.
Oh, well, thank you.
I'm not an advice columnist, but I thought it worked. Well, as we wind up here, I'm wondering if there's anything you'd like to add that maybe my questions have failed to elicit.
I think you did a wonderful job. Oh, I will just say part of the theme in the new book was about a sand play therapist. And that was something that I could say a little bit about. It was something that I made one of my main character's friends. I had her be a sand play therapist, which without knowing anything about it in the first book. And then when it came time to write the third book, and this character, whose name was Annabelle, was going to be one of the main characters, I had to do some research about it so I wouldn't make the same mistake of making a therapist look foolish by having errors. And there was a sand play therapist in Exeter, New Hampshire, who helped me, who walked me through all the details of how it's based on the theories of Jung, and people come in and place figurines in the sand, and then the therapist and patient sit together and talk through what the tray that they've made means.
Yes.
So that was really interesting. It's just an example of how you're just always learning things as you go.
Right. Yes, I really like that part. I actually, one of my interviews, if you go back, you'll find I did an interview with a sand play, a Jungian analyst, sand play therapist. And one of my good friends just returned from a training in Switzerland, actually, at the Jung Institute for that very thing. And I thought you did a good job of rendering it.
Well, thanks to Sally, who straightened me out.
Okay.
That was a lot. It was very interesting. Yeah.
Okay, well, Roberta, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Roberta Islib. If you're curious to see what she looks like, there's an interview with her on the web. Go to www.wtnh.com. And then do a search on that site for Islib. It's spelled I-S-L-E-I-B. Actually, you'll find several interviews with her there. And she also has a website and a couple of blogs that you might enjoy. Now, you'll find her website at www.robertaislib.com. And her blogs are at www.jungleredwriters.com. and www.robertaislib.com/blog. Now, having just finished it and finding it an enjoyable read, I can recommend her latest, Asking for Murder. It's published by Berkeley in paperback, so it won't break the bank. Aside from being a good mystery yarn, it also gives very nice and accurate glimpses into the workings, the mind of a clinical psychologist in private practice. Speaking of murder mysteries, newer listeners may not be aware that a few years ago, I co-authored a book on the Zodiac serial killer. My job was to develop a psychological profile of this killer who was never caught. I keep thinking my involvement with the Zodiac case is over, but it keeps popping back up. Just this week, I got a call from a reporter for a major U.S. magazine who told me that the FBI is analyzing the DNA of a new suspect. If it confirms that this guy is the Zodiac, they'll be running a major story on the case. Then a day later, I get an email from Tom Voigt, who runs the ZodiacKiller.com discussion board, asking me if I would be willing to MC the Zodiac Task Force event at a theater in San Francisco again this year. I say again because I did it last year on the day that the Zodiac movie came out, and by the way, my co-author appeared in the film credits as a technical consultant on that film. At any rate, it will be the 40th anniversary of one of the key Zodiac attacks, and there will be a number of people involved with the case who will be speaking at this event on December 20th in San Francisco. I sure hope this latest suspect pans out. Then we'll really have something to talk about, and it would allow me to see how accurate my profile of the Zodiac was or was not.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Radio, shrink back, radio, shrink.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
I've got a new interview up on my other podcast series at www.wisecounselpodcast.com, where I had a fascinating and inspiring conversation with James Gordon, MD, on mind-body medicine and his book, Unstuck. Hey, the poll on our website at Shrink Wrap Radio is still running. It asks the question, if it were reasonably priced, would you be likely to subscribe to Shrink Wrap Radio premium content? For example, interviews that would not be available for free, transcripts, special compilations, etc. So I hope you will weigh in on this if you haven't done so already. And the top widgets spot on our site, our top spots widget. And the top spots widget on our site is a place where you can help support the show and advertise your blog, website, or service at the same time, all for a mere $20 PayPal donation. And it's your ad will be up there for months based on past experience. And right now it looks like all the slots are full, but in fact there's room for you, because when you sign up, you'll bump somebody off the bottom of the list who's been there for a long, long time. Now don't forget, I'm offering to send a copy of the book by Ronald Dworkin, MD, PhD, titled Artificial Happiness, Using Antidepressants to Mask Ordinary Unhappiness, to the lucky U.S. winner of the Transitions Contest that is running through the month of September. You've got a great chance of winning, because still nobody has sent me one yet. Mevio has brought us several new sponsors, each offering you discount savings, and you'll find links on our website to discounts at GoDaddy, Brookstone.com, and PetMeds.com. Using those codes not only saves you money, but also helps to support Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, this is Mike from Cape Town, South Africa. Been listening to the podcast, Dr. Dave, and really enjoying your show. There's some fantastic, interesting content, and looking forward to everything else that's going to be coming our way down in Africa. You take care.
Hey, Mike, thanks for that transition you sent way back when. I hope you're still listening. Let's catch up with some of those back emails. Here's one from Alex, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I'm still listening and am continuously amazed at the quality and depth of your shows. Nobody else on the net is as able to gently encourage his interviewees to bring their stories forward as you are. It's quite extraordinary. Tech bit. We had some conversations via email a few months ago regarding a Shrink Wrap Radio forum, and I'm glad to say that I may soon have the time and settledness to be able to offer my technical and administrative services, if that's still on the table. I'm thinking of starting up an official Shrink Wrap Radio forum in, say, 2 months on my own website. If I can get that going, I'll certainly let you know. That could be a lead-in to something more official. Unofficial forums often spring up for things on the internet, from political parties to computer games, and their unofficialness can be an asset. Nonetheless, my long-term wish is to see a Shrink Wrap Radio forum. One reason that continues to motivate me is your post-show notes on the air. I really enjoy the emails and listener feedback section, but I think that some of the other stuff could be well handled by directing listeners to a forum where ongoing announcements could live. It must be that 99% of the listeners have internet access, and those many of us who want to be more involved would have no trouble communicating about that off-air. Then he says, end of tech bit. I hope you're doing well, and my best wishes to you and your family and friends. You've brought a great gift to the world that will be treasured for all time. I mean, think of the fantastic interviews you've done with key figures in the field already. That's Library of Congress material for certain. Speaking of guests, you mentioned wanting to get Natasha Mitchell as a guest of All in the Mind. I think that would be fantastic. Three things. Her background, she was a girl engineer, her words. Her interest in the mind. Get personal, I think there's a secret there that she wants to tell, and her role in the world of psychology. She's interviewed many important people, as you have, and she's hosted some big events. Does she see herself in any particular role? with regards to the public perception and development of the field of psychology and psychiatry. Another dream guest would be Armand Demely. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Armand Demely, host of The Positive Mind, which can be found at thepositivemind.com. He says, you guys are polar opposites. If you interview him, he'd take the passive road and talk about himself gladly. Who among us wouldn't respond to your inviting attitude? What would be extremely interesting is if the two of you discuss something of interest to you both. He's very quick off the draw to form conclusions, and I think he's typically New York City in that he's concerned with power. The butting of heads of you two would be fascinating for your fans and might just spark something quite extraordinary. I dare you. Well, Dr. Dave, take care. Best regards from the industrial megalopolis of Baltimore. Okay, well, there's a lot in that message to respond to. You know, the idea of a forum is something that certainly I consider from time to time, and it's sort of recently been a draw between a forum or getting a newsletter out on a regular basis. And this also plays into some of my wonderings about whether or not I should be monetizing the show somehow, because there are various financial pressures that are coming to bear on me, and some financial situation has changed. But I have very mixed feelings about that, and that's why I've got that poll up there. And I don't know if people will use a forum or respond to newsletters or not. I really appreciate what you had to say about me having compiled kind of an invaluable Library of Congress type resource within psychology. You know, I really think that's true as I look back over it in all modesty and humbleness, not because I'm so great, but I have, in fact, been fortunate enough to talk to such a collection of people who are really major leaders in one way or another between this podcast and the other one, that sometimes it amazes me, I can tell you. I appreciate your suggestions for guests. I still haven't managed to nab Natasha Mitchell, but I think your suggestions for some areas to explore are excellent, and I haven't gotten around to looking into Armand yet, but that's something that I need to do. Thanks so much for your offer, though, to host a forum, and we should continue to talk about that, because that's probably is a possibility that I should consider. And next we hear from another longtime listener, Rick, and he writes, hey, Dr. Dave, I just wanted to let you know that I finally got into the most prestigious lab at San Diego State, it's SDSU, San Diego State University. This was my first choice under the most challenging of senior scientists, and on the top of that, they only take a couple of undergrads per year, and I'm one of them, so it's a big deal. Hey, congratulations, Rick. I'm telling you this because you and your many guests are a big part of my success. I have my faults, but not listening isn't one of them, yay. I'm always receptive to the creative. Indeed, whatever is running things out there has decided to use your show to help me along in my life. Because I have turned so many people at school onto your show, I feel it best to keep this between us. Thanks for following your bliss. Happy Labor Day, my friend. Sincerely, Rick Vail. Hey, I hope I didn't spill any beans there that I wasn't supposed to. That last remark was a little bit cryptic. Well, I wasn't sure what the OERP lab was about or just what Rick was doing. I know he's a returning student, if I recall correctly, in his 40s. And very excited to be involved in the scientific aspects of psychology. So I sent him a query, and he followed up with the following. I'm in the OERP lab measuring amplitude and latency in response to an odor stimulus in three age groups, young, middle, and old. We know that olfaction breaks down with the onset of dementia. This study will give us a better idea of the progression of that breakdown. The primary instrument for measuring postsynaptic potentials we are using is EEG, but we'll also be doing some stuff with the fMRI. Hey, that's really hot new equipment. Later, to better localize the responses we are currently recording. I actually conducted my first experiment last Wednesday and enjoyed it very much, But there's a lot to doing this kind of stuff, and I really know hardly anything at this point, but I'm enjoying the learning process. The best part of all of this is that Dr. Claire Murphy's recommendation carries a huge amount of weight wherever I end up applying to grad school. I figured you would appreciate hearing the news and the impact your show has had in helping me refine my focus. The other day, someone told me that I had a major impact on their life and how important I was to them and how inspiring my journey has been to them. I was honored that they felt that way about me and realized that all the hours I spend alone in an office grinding out my studies may seem isolated and unnoticed, but in reality has impact that I can't fully see or understand. I feel pretty confident that you must have moments when you're handling the less enjoyable aspects of doing your podcasts, such as editing and engineering alone in your office, that you wonder how what you're doing is making a difference. Well, it is in my life and the lives of others who I've shared your show with, along with countless others that will never take the time to write you. I am into the whole acknowledgement thing. I think we all need to know we are noticed when we do the right thing. We sure as hell are noticed fast when we do the wrong thing. Sincerely, Rick. P.S. I love your commitment to the scientific method. Hey, Rick, I'm glad you noticed that I have a commitment to the scientific method. Since I interview such a wide spectrum of people, I think some people suspect me of being overly tender-minded, perhaps. Well, at the risk of turning this into the Rick show, I wrote him again, pointing out that I still didn't know what OERP stands for. And so he wrote back, he said, "Hey, Dave, to answer your questions, OERP stands for olfactory event-related potentials. I am still a psych person, but I am in what is for me the best of both worlds, the hard science and behavioral component combined and correlated. I couldn't agree more with that being a therapist is a whole lot more like being a shaman than a scientist coldly analyzing and then assisting others in resolving problems. By the way, I think being a therapist is a wonderful choice," he says. "At first, that's what I wanted to do, and then I ended up leaning totally hard science. But recently, I was able to do some applied stuff that made me think again about doing hands-on work with clients. I'm open to whatever the creative has in mind for me. And in the meantime, I just put one foot in front of the other, enjoying seeing my destiny unfold in front of me. In the end, I want to do as much good as I can before I end up being worm food. And I also want my kids to be able to point at me and say their dad was a never quit kind of guy who followed his heart while at the same time being responsible and loving to those who depend on him. Ever since I turned 45 years ago, I've become so aware of time and how little of it we have. Anyhow, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Take care, Rick." Okay, Rick, I really appreciate getting all that rich feedback, and I love your excitement for your path, for the path that you're on, and I'm so happy to be able to share it with a wider audience, and I really appreciate the love that you're sending my way. Now, here's another short email from someone else by way of a suggestion, no signature, but it reads, "Hi, I've just discovered your podcast, and I'm really enjoying the diversity of views you present. My only gripe so far is that the abstracts are usually about the guest rather than the content of the show. Could you give us a quick idea of what you've talked about? Thanks for the show." Well, that was good feedback, and, you know, I try to do that in the titles, but sometimes the titles are a bit cryptic. So I'm going to try to keep that in mind and try to be a little bit better in the show notes to give a sense of what the show is about and not just to talk about the guest. And I don't know if you've noticed, but I've also shortened what I say about the guest on the podcast here and am directing people to the show notes if they want to find out more about the guest. And I'm doing that to kind of speed up getting into the interview. And I just thought maybe that would be a good move. And hopefully you listeners out there agree with this minor adjustment on my part. Okay, finally, it was good to hear from listener and guest Sarah Hannah Radcliffe after a long hiatus. And she writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm so sorry I didn't get to you sooner. I noticed that after my recent comments on how much I enjoyed the music on your show, you created some new tunes right away, only I don't recall right now if there was just one new one or more." Well, there really was just one new one. "I just remember enjoying something very much, and I'd love to hear more of it. Has anyone else noticed or commented? The other thing I wanted to mention is my suggestion for your title for the piece that you do with Jerry Trumbull. Since it's the two of you talking, I thought an appropriate title for the segment would be Shrink Wrapping, and that would be spelled S-H-R-I-N-K-R-A-P-P-I-N-G. What do you think?" It's clever. I kind of like it. "Finally," she says, "I've really enjoyed your show as usual, particularly The Way of the Ninja. Keep up the good work, Sarah Hanna." And Sarah Hanna has been a guest a couple of times, and I'll probably have her on again. She's the author of Raise Your Kids Without Raising Your Voice, a wonderful book. And her website, you'll find it, parenting-advice.net. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send me emails at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about the shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype or use the My Chingo button that's on our site to record messages. And finally, we have a message phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Roberta Islieb for giving us a glimpse of the life of the psychotherapist as mystery writer. And next week's guest is an acquaintance who's written a new book on Toltec wisdom and how to bring it into modern life. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.